Book 1. Chapter 1. Fire in the Cockpit. When the moon rises beyond the Atlantic shore of Florida, full and luminous, it seems so close that you could just row out to the end of the water and touch it. In January 1967, the moon seemed to draw nearer by the day to the hard, flat beaches of Cape Kennedy. Seen from there, it was no longer the governess of the tides, the lover's beacon, the celebrated mistress of song. It was a target, a Cold War beachhead in the sky. It was NASA's moon. Almost 6 years had passed since John Kennedy's challenge for a lunar landing by decade's end. The moon program had grown into an effort whose size and complexity dwarfed even the Manhattan Project. At aerospace contractors around the country, 400,000 people were hard at work on the moon ships for Project Apollo. Meanwhile, Project Gemini had just come to a spectacular finale. These two manned missions had bridged the gap between the pioneering Mercury flights and the challenge of the lunar landing. For the first time in the race to the moon, the United States appeared to have pulled ahead of the Soviet Union. With the first manned Earth orbit Apollo flight scheduled for mid-February, all seemed on target to make Kennedy's vision a reality. But one evening, late in January, that soaring optimism suddenly, terribly fell to earth. January 27th, 1967, Merritt Island Launch Area, Kennedy Space Center, Cape Kennedy, Florida. How are we going to get to the moon if we can't talk between three buildings? Gus Grissom's voice was low and calm, but with an unmistakable edge of irritation. A senior astronaut, veteran of two space missions, Grissom was the commander of the first manned Apollo flight set for February 1967. On this warm January afternoon, Grissom and his crew, veteran astronaut Ed White and a rookie named Roger Chaffee, were participating in a simulated countdown, the kind of routine test that preceded every mission. They were sealed inside the cone-shaped Apollo 1 command module, high atop a huge Saturn 1B booster rocket at Pad 34, one of dozens of launch complexes that lined the beach at Cape Kennedy. A few hundred yards away, inside the concrete bunker called the Saturn Blockhouse, some 200 members of the launch team heard Grissom's words. At the capsule communicator, or Stony console, a young rookie astronaut named Stuart Roosa tried in vain to answer. "Apollo 1, this is Stony. How do you read?" In 1967, there were so many astronauts that Grissom and Roosa hardly knew each other, but the younger man could hear the barely contained exasperation in Grissom's voice. "I can't hear a thing you're saying. Jesus Christ, I said, how are we going to get to the moon if we can't talk between two or three buildings?" No one who knew Gus Grissom took him lightly. Small and powerful, he was known as a fierce competitor. When Grissom was a young Air Force fighter pilot in the Korean War, the Flyers would ride an old school bus from the hangar to the flight line. Only those who had been in air-to-air combat could sit down. The uninitiated pilots had to stand. Grissom stood only once. He brought the same hard-driving determination to his spaceflight career as one of the Mercury astronauts known as the Original Seven. Even among these most elite flyers, the Seven had a status approaching royalty. Despite their rivalries, they had a unique bond that came from being the first Americans to venture into the heavens. Everything the Original Seven did was energized with competition, from flying airplanes to their impromptu drag races on straight Florida roads to their adventures in the night spots of Cocoa Beach, and Grissom was always a zealous participant. But even to other astronauts, Grissom was not an easy man to know. He was a loner among loners.